This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, James Redford, owes his life to the deaths of two generous strangers, two people who, upon their deaths, became organ donors. Redford had two liver transplants in 1993 after 5 years of declining health from liver disease. Now he heads the James Redford Institute for Transplant Awareness. 12 people die every day because they're awaiting a transplant and can't get an organ. Only 0.5% of the people who die each year qualify to be organ donors. An organ can only be harvested from someone who is brain dead but was otherwise in good health. Redford is the executive producer of a new documentary about organ donors and recipients called The Kindness of Strangers. It premieres tomorrow on HBO. Redford is a screenwriter who grew up with movies. His father is Robert Redford. James Redford discovered he had liver disease in 1987 when he was moving from Colorado to Chicago to attend graduate school. Before the move, he had a physical.
There was a curious liver enzyme test, and no one really thought much about it, and I was brought in to do a procedure just to make sure it wasn't the thing that they thought it might be, which was a 2 to 3% chance. And when I woke up from the procedure, I had a whole flank of doctors around my bed with long faces, and I knew it right then. I had kind of woken up to the wrong end of the odds, and it was told to me at that point that I had about 5 to 10 years to live with this liver disease, and that transplant would be my only option. And of course, at that point in 1987, the public awareness of transplantation was very little, and I think at that point it wasn't being covered by insurance yet, and there was very little known about it. So for me, when they said that was my only option, I didn't really have much faith in that as being something that could really actually save my life. So I went into a period of sort of, you know, denial on one hand, just sort of thinking, well, 5 to 10 years, someone will figure out a cure, or I'll be someone that doesn't progress. Somehow I'll avoid this. But I didn't avoid it. I tried everything under the sun, but it was inevitable, and it did wind down after about 5 years that transplantation was the only option.
What stage did you have to reach medically before the doctor said, okay, you need it now, you need the transplant now?
The idea was to sort of watch the symptoms, watch the problems that arise, and they have an idea of, you know, when you have sort of a year to go before you're going to die. And they look at the waiting list, and because they don't want to put you on too early, because the transplantation itself is a risky operation. And, you know, they want you to be able to enjoy your life as long as you can, because there are no guarantees. So, and there's also obviously a scarcity issue and a priority issue that they have to honor ethically. And at that time in 93, I think they were thinking, with the time I was put on the list, they were thinking I had about a year to go.
How are you feeling then?
Liver disease is sort of an insidious disease. It creeps up on you slowly, and you don't really, you know, you'll have sudden problems. I had abdominal pains a lot. But it can also act insidiously. It's slow, kind of creeping lethargy and a wasting away of your strength and your stamina. I had, you know, at the end there, I turned jaundiced. I was not feeling well at all.
When you found out that you were on the waiting list and you would only have a year unless you had the transplant, did you feel it when you were waiting for the transplant as if you were waiting to get sicker so that you could get better? You know?
Yes, there is that terrible irony in the whole thing, where that dynamic actually was most kind of noticeable to me, and that was the case in the wait, which was about 6 months. But after my first transplant, there was a surgical complication that led to the donated organ was compromised. And about a week after the first transplant, it was clear that there was something wrong. And they were unable to tell what the ramifications of this problem were going to be, but the doctors were not all that encouraging that in the long term it would be a viable organ. But because of the protocol that they were using at UNMC and still use, and everybody uses, I think, they had to assume that there I was on that given day. I was doing relatively well at that moment. And they had to make an assumption that I was okay and release me from the hospital. And my status dropped back to the beginning. Although everybody sort of knew that the problems were probably going to recur and I would eventually need to be retransplanted, I had to basically get back in the at the end of the line and start over again. And that was exactly what happened. It was a slow process, and I, in fact, did start to run into more problems. I got very, very ill waiting for the second one.
When you get the word that there's a donor, things must happen pretty quickly. Can you give me a sense of what it was like for you the first or the second time, you know, whichever you prefer, when you found out that there was a donor? How much time do you have to assimilate that before you're actually in the operating room?
Well, in my case, the first time I was in my hospital room, it was in the evening, and my wife had gone home to Denver from Omaha to get things in order. She'd come with me to the hospital because I was having some trouble, and she'd gone home. We had an 18-month-old boy at the time, so she'd gone home to get some things in order. But I was alone in my room that night and sort of hanging out, and the phone rang, and there was a nurse on the line, and she said, "Hi, this is Young. I'm your transplant coordinator. We found a liver for you." And my first reaction was that it was one of my friends that was calling and playing a joke on me. I was totally shocked. Even though we'd been waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting, when the time finally came, it just seemed almost impossible to comprehend. But no, it was very quickly made clear that it was not a joke, that it was happening. And then there were calls to family members in the middle of the night, some people jumping on airplanes to get there as quickly as possible. My wife turned around and flew back immediately. And those 6 to 8 hours were a very reflective period. It was pretty much through the middle of the night on into morning, and gave me some time to think about things, for sure. Think about some things I wanted maybe to, you know, have say in writing, which I did. Very contemplative.
Were you preparing for either a new life or for death, depending on which way it went?
That's right.
You said in an interview someplace that it took you a while to recognize that your need for a transplant wasn't going to cause someone else to die. Would you elaborate on that thought that, you know, that your life depends on someone else's death, and what a kind of odd relationship it is to that other person?
It's a very odd relationship, and it, you know, there is an element of guilt, I think, in all of that. I mean, recipients are really, you know, highly involved with giving back to this cause, and some of that, I think, is a little bit of a guilt in a way that is hard to fully dismiss, even though you know that your illness and your situation and your fate, the road you're on in this life, and the fact that you've got an illness that has resulted in this need, has nothing to do with someone in a neighboring state or region that's had a traumatic accident or an aneurysm or something that's led to brain death, that they're not linked. There is that kind of indefinable connection to it all that stays with you forever. And in fact, for me, as strange as it is, it's actually been a gift in a way, this sort of, you know, this feeling of indebtedness, because it's just kept me constantly aware of how precious life is. I just don't take it for granted. Not that I don't have my bad days.
Right. There's a couple of parents of an organ donor in the movie, and they say something very moving. They say, you know, when you're told that your child is brain dead, you know that what you're really being told is that they're dead, but still, before you say go ahead and take the organs, you have doubts like, well, maybe the doctors are giving up prematurely because they want the organs. And the parents just can't help but wonder, have I truly, really done everything possible to save my child? And I think it must be such a difficult position for the family of someone who is brain dead to say, okay, now go ahead, you know, we give them up for dead, take the organs.
Absolutely. I mean, you're you're putting the medical world in the position of calling a shot that's very, very difficult to call. And, you know, I think the people that are in the greatest disadvantage are the ones who arrive at this situation and say their child has signed their driver's license, or their husband or whoever it is in the family, and they haven't ever confronted this issue or talked about it amongst themselves, and suddenly in the middle of what has to be the worst moment of their lives, they're being confronted with this decision. And who is going to really be in a frame of mind to be contemplating a decision that basically involves the well-being of other people, of strangers somewhere else that have nothing to do with your trauma, your crisis? And in that sense, I think it's a miracle that organ donation happens at all. And it's a real testament to the human capacity for sacrifice and true altruism, that this takes place at all. And it's why I have reservations about the notion of sort of reimbursal or remuneration or connected, because I think there's something very far more powerful at stake here that's happening when strangers do these things.
Yeah, in the movie, there's two parents of a teenage girl who died in a car accident, and she had asked that her organs be donated in case of death. Now, the father says in the movie that if he didn't know that his daughter had wanted that, he would have opposed donating her organs. He didn't like the idea of his daughter's body being taken apart after death. I think he used the word desecrated. And his wife, the girl's mother, says that she wouldn't have tried to convince her husband because their daughter was already dead. In that sense, she was out of the picture. But he would have to live with the decision for the rest of his life. I was wondering what your reaction was to hearing that.
Well, I think the Kilmers, Kathy and Russ, represent the real spectrum of the anguish of that decision. And I think you hear it and you see it, and there's no denying these points of view, and I certainly relate to it. I'm a father myself and of two children, and I try and imagine myself making that choice, and I understand all of those sort of visceral reactions to this topic. And I think that's why, in the end, you know, you have to think of Megan and what a beautiful person she was to have thought about this. And
this is
what a remarkable thing. The daughter, yes, mm-hmm. Megan, who was killed in the car accident. And, you know, clearly it was Megan's impulse, and they honored that. And that's what we're talking about in terms of it being a discussion among family members. If it's something that one embraces, it's not a decision that should be kept to oneself, or simply signing your driver's license. That doesn't do it either, by the way. I mean, there's this idea that, oh, I'll sign my driver's license and that'll take care of this. But the decision is left to the loved ones. It's not automatically done according to your driver's license.
Really? So even if you say in your license that you want to be an organ donor, if you become brain dead in a car accident, your family still has to sign off on it?
That's right. It's their call.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's something right about that.
My guest is James Redford. He's the executive producer of the documentary The Kindness of Strangers, about organ donors and recipients. It premieres tomorrow on HBO. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Redford. 6 years ago, he had two liver transplants. Now he's produced a new documentary about organ donors and recipients. Now, you had two liver transplants because the first one didn't take. Do you know who the livers came from and how they died?
Well, I'm aware that the first one that came to me was a result of a brain aneurysm in a young male. The second one was a result of an accident. The conditions were left intentionally vague, particularly at the onset. And then, as you go on, it becomes a little bit more specific when, for instance, you know, when I came out of my experiences, I very much wanted to write the donor families and express, obviously, my gratitude. And the coordinators that handle, the transplant coordinators handle this kind of exchange of information between donor families and recipients. And initially, it's sort of, they take out all of the personal references that could create a situation where the identification, specific identities between people could be made until it's determined that both sides of the equation, the recipients and the donor families, want to have an interaction. And at that time, more personal information is given and the connection is made. In my case, I was interested in that connection, but the responses to my letters from the donor families, I think, was similar in sort of sensibility to the Kilmers in our film, which is we did it. We honored our child's decision to support this thing called organ donation, and you know we're glad we honored that, but we're moving on with our life, and you know why don't you do the same? And so I've never had that contact with the donor families that some patients do have.
One of the organ donations didn't take. There was a problem with the liver. What kind of message did you want to send to that family? You couldn't send the message, you know, your loved one's organ saved my life, because it didn't save your life. It almost did, but it didn't.
Well, I tell you how I feel about that. I don't know if this is the sort of rationalization that we all, you know, dive into in these situations, but the truth is that I went for 4 months with that liver, and it became a part of me, even though it was a problem. And I think I look back on that, and I think, you know, the way liver disease works, it's just so hard to know what would have happened. The fact is that, you know, during that time, it was mine, and it kept me alive for 4 more months. Who knows how long I would have waited or what would have happened, or if a different organ wouldn't have had a different problem. So, you know, I never really saw it as just an out-and-out failure. I saw it as sort of a step along a very difficult journey for me. And I certainly never entertained the idea of, you know, writing a letter to the family and giving them the specifics of that. I didn't think that was fair to them.
After a transplant, you have to be very careful about your body rejecting the transplanted organ. What kind of medicine have you been on to prevent rejection?
Well, I'm on a medication called cyclosporine, which really revolutionized transplantation in the early to mid-80s. It was originally a medication that was researched, I think, by a young Japanese research specialist who was looking at a cancer-fighting drug, and he stumbled on a mold spore that not only did it not work, but it was killing mice like crazy. They were coming down with all kinds of tumors, so it was obviously shelved. And then somewhere along the line, someone said, hey, wait a minute, the immune system and cancer are inextricably linked, and if this drug was you know, promoting tumor growth, perhaps it was an immunosuppressant behavior that was happening with this drug. So they started to experiment with the spore, and lo and behold, it did succeed in suppressing the immune system in a manner that almost, you know, overnight shot up survival rates from transplantation from the 30 to 40% range up into the 80% range. And it was a revolution in the field, and I'm certainly glad that this was my fate to have to be transplanted, that it happened when it did.
So the cyclosporin lowers your immune system, yes?
That's right.
It weakens your immune system, which means that you're more vulnerable to other bugs of every sort, which isn't a good thing if you're a hypochondriac.
No, it isn't. I tell you, you know, it took me a while. You know, when I came out of it, to go into shopping malls or theaters, you'd sort of sit there thinking, "Oh boy, what am I picking up?"
You know. Yeah. Well, it's a real fear. I mean.
Oh, certainly, certainly. I've been pleasantly surprised in my case that. That I haven't really noticed a whole real difference. I think when I pick up colds and things, they tend to linger maybe a little longer. But the upside of that is they never hit quite as hard as they used to because the immune system isn't knocking me out. So it's and they, you know, on a more serious note, there are certain issues you have to sort of, you know, hope that don't come up involving increased cancer risks and certain infections that can become life threatening. If I'm sitting here looking for a piece of wood to knock on, I've been lucky that way.
Mm-hmm. My guest is James Redford. He's the executive producer of the documentary The Kindness of Strangers about organ donors and recipients. It premieres tomorrow on HBO. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Redford. 6 years ago, he had two liver transplants. Now he's produced a new documentary about organ donors and recipients. Does where you live at all affect your chances of getting an organ donated? In other words, if you're in a more populated area, do your chances of getting an organ donation go up?
Well, it's sort of like that, the speed, you know, the approaching the speed of light, that strange thing with Einstein where you have to, you know, the faster you go, the more mass you need to make it go faster, and you never quite catch up, you know. It's similar in this regard in that you have a higher population base, but you also have a higher patient load. And in the larger city areas, you often have larger transplant centers that are more renowned, that have a much longer list, because people have gone there, like I did, wanting to see the repetition. And so as the population goes up and the amount of donation taking place goes up, you also see the amount of patients waiting going up. But there are clearly discrepancies in these various regions, and some people do go to more remote areas where, for instance, a new program is starting up and they don't have a patient load that, say, a Nebraska or UCLA or UCSF has, and they're willing to sort of dive in there with a new program because they can't afford to or do not want to chance the wait. So there is a discrepancy in this wait and geographically. There is that.
You're now running an institute that's basically an educational institute about organ transplantation, you know, plus you made your new documentary about it. And I know through this work you're in touch with a lot of doctors who know the state-of-the-art medicine. From what you know, what do you see as the future in the near future of organ transplant medicine?
I think the hope is that there can be sort of the cell line research, which is sort of taking the cells and of you know, tissues, the DNA, and growing them outwards, the tissues from various organs, and hopefully maybe through fetal cell research or other cell research, being able to grow in vitro these organs, so that we're not reliant on this terrible dilemma of the current organ donation dynamic. No one wants this, you know, and that's certainly a hope. I think there are other promising things on the horizon, particularly in the case of livers, which is the split liver operation that seems to be becoming more prominent right now, in which someone can go in and donate the right or the left lobe. My medical awareness dims here, but one of the lobes can be separated and donated into a recipient. And then within months, it grows to normal size. And that's something that may ease things. Mm-hmm. I think the other area that there may be advancement is in the area of immunosuppressants, in terms of right now, you're basically, it's a very kind of a blanket approach to immunosuppression, in which the entire immune system is suppressed for the sake of keeping the organ. Perhaps in the future, they'll figure out ways to suppress certain segments of the immune system related to rejection while allowing other segments to remain fully functioning.
What's the prospect now for someone like you who has an organ transplant? What do the doctors tell you about, longevity?
Well, I appreciate the sort of philosophy at Nebraska, which is sort of assume the best. Mm-hmm. But it took me a while to get there. The future of any recipient is sort of the great unknown. There's a sense of being on the frontier of science. It's, you know, it hasn't been going on long enough to really have any long-term clinical studies about what the 20-year, 30-year prognosis is. So there's no real way to know. And initially, the first 6 months after my transplant, that was something I really wrestled with and struggled with mightily, in fact. It's, what does this all mean? Where am I? You know, what can I really anticipate here? the unknown was sort of daunting. And then a funny thing happened. That same sense of unknown became the gift for me, because I realized that that in that unknown was a kind of a responsibility to celebrate every day, much the way you hear some cancer patients talk. And it's never really left me, you know, and I don't take anything for granted, really. I mean, as I said before, I have my occasional fits of road rage like anyone else, but, you know, I have a real sense that each day is a gift, and, you know, I'm taking medicine twice a day, so that it never is far from my mind, and I just have to take each day as it comes and expect the best, because I think that's the best way to look at it.
Well, Jamie Redford, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
James Redford is the founder of the James Redford Institute for Transplant Awareness and the executive producer of the new documentary about organ donors and recipients called The Kindness of Strangers. The film was directed by Mauro Tremayoff. It premieres tomorrow night on HBO. I'm Terry Gross.